Hello and welcome once again to Under Western Stars. I'm your host, Tony Norris, and we're picking up where we left off last time with Steve Alston talking about sourdough bread. I don't know if they were historically growing wheat here in Doney Park, but I know they grew rye because the remnants of it still fill the ditches and the vacant fields, and it's a very hardy plant with no watering at all in dry years. It grows 3 foot high and produces heavy heads of rye.
Yeah, in fact, you and I have gone out and collected some of those in years past. So they did out in Doney Park, over the years when Doney Park was all farms, they've grown a whole host of things, beans, potatoes, and wheat was one of them. There's a great picture in the Cooperative Extension Office. I don't know what year it's from, but it's a picture of a farmer standing out in his field, and it's a wheat field, and the wheat comes about waist high on the farmer. And where he's standing, when you look at it, you can see, oh, that's Old Cave's crater in the background of that picture.
Oh, okay.
And so definitely wheat was growing out here.
Right down there.
Just right off the hill there, it would have been grown. and it was, for a time, a pretty big crop. In fact, Flagstaff did have its own flour mill back in the early 1920s. It was right in downtown, right off of 66, right by the train tracks. At the time, the wheat that was grown in Coconino County all got shipped down to Phoenix, got milled in Phoenix, and got shipped back up to Flagstaff. And somebody scratched their head and said, well, that doesn't make any sense. Why don't we keep the Coconino County grown wheat in Coconino County and let's process it here and we can reduce the price because we're not paying to ship it down to Phoenix and paying to ship it back up. And so they created it. It was called the Flagstaff Milling Company, and it sadly was only around for a few years. But they had their own brand of flour called Flavo flour, and it was Flagstaff's own, Coconino County's own variety of flour. The mill did give out grains to be grown to the farmers, so they were giving out things. There's a couple of varieties they gave out. Marquee wheat was one of them. Red Russian wheat was another one of them, to encourage the farmers to, hey, grow wheat and bring it here, and we can mill it into flour, and we can sell it here locally as our own Flagstaff brand of flour. The rye that you speak to here, so if you go into the Cooperative Extension Office records, they start in about 1917, and in that first year records, they talk about the farmers growing rye as a cover crop over the winter. So this would be something you would grow to keep the fertility in your fields, keep them aerated, and then, you know, before it went to seed, you would disc it under into the ground, and it formed a green manure to provide some fertilizer in the soil. So somewhere along the way, somebody must have just let their crop of rye keep on going, and it's now feral, and like you said, grows in the ditches around here, and we've gone out and harvested it, and I took some of it and put it in the Rocky Mountain Seed Alliance grain collection. I named it Coachfield Rye because that's where we collected it. It was on Coachfield, so seemed to make sense to call it that. But yeah, there is a history of growing grains here in the Flagstaff.
Have you had any experience with the Sonoran wheat, which I assume the conquistadors brought with them?
Yeah, Sonoran wheat's that's a great one. I have grown Sonoran wheat. It grows really well here. It was one of the varieties that the farmers did grow here. As far as we know, Sonoran white was brought by Father Kino when he came into Mexico and then worked his way up into the Southwest. And they brought that wheat variety with them because they didn't know if there would be wheat available there for them to make their sacramental breads. And for a time, it was very, very popular to be grown in Arizona. The really cool thing about Arizona is it's almost the perfect climate for growing wheat. You know, especially up here with the monsoon season. So when the plant needs water, we have all these great monsoon rains in a good year. And when it doesn't need water, you want it to dry out, those monsoon rains go away for spring wheats. Winter wheats were grown here too, experimented with, and didn't do very well. And that's been my experience. I've grown winter wheat here too. It doesn't do very well here. It's hard to winter it over. with the exception of rye. Rye is a winter grain. Rye does really well here. I've had good luck with that. But with the Sonoran white, you know, it was grown a lot. In fact, during the Civil War, you know, Arizona provided a lot of wheat to the East Coast. You know, one of the things that you would do is to try to conquer a city in the Civil War, as they went through, they burnt down all the wheat fields. You know, get rid of your food supplies and we'll starve you out, type of a thing, right? So Arizona did provide a lot of wheat during the Civil War, and a lot of that was the Sonoran white. Yeah, and then it during the Green Revolution, when Norman Borlaug was developing his variety of wheat that wouldn't lodge, which is when it grows up too tall, you know, it falls over and it rots on the ground, you can't use it. You know, he was trying to breed varieties that had really big fat seed heads, but were of a shorter height, so they didn't lodge or fall over. Their stalk was a little bit thicker, you know, all things that would make it easier to industrially process. And during that time, a lot of the Sonoran white was lost. And it wasn't until Gary Nabhan in the, I'll get the date wrong, but in the 80s, 70s, 80s, or 90s, somewhere in that time period, down with one of the Southern Arizona tribes, and I don't remember which one it was, he was gifted a coffee can by an old woman who said, "This is the last of it." Nobody was growing anymore, and that was, as far as we know, was the last of any of the Sonoran white that existed. So fortunately, he got a hold of it, took it back to Native Seed Search, and they planted it all out, and now you can find it all over the place. You know, you can buy seed packets of it everywhere. The Grow Flagstaff Seed Library has packets, or they have in the past had packets of Sonoran white. So it's a great story of, you know, having a grain like that with a great history, but has been brought back from what we thought was extinction.
I saw a field of the Native Seed Search Sonoran white wheat. I don't know how many years ago it's been, but it was beautiful. The plants were like 3 foot high, and it had a wonderful sort of a coppery golden mm-hmm. color to it. It was right at harvest season when I saw it.
Yeah, there's I've been growing wheat for a number of years here, and there's something about, you know, the end of the day, you go out to your little wheat field and you walk through it and you run your hand through the weeds, and it's very, very grounding, very calming. You know, sometimes I would just sit down in the middle of the wheat field and, you know, you watch the moonlight dance off of the wheat and make the shadows on the ground and everything. And it's just, I highly recommend it to everybody to at least once in your life walk through a wheat field and do that.
You brought a loaf of your sourdough with you here today.
I did. We can't talk about bread and not eat it.
This loaf was about 16 inches long and maybe 6-8 inches high, and it's got a wonderful mottled brown crust with a ridge where I guess you've scored the dough before you cooked it.
Yep.
And as you were slicing it while ago, I loved the sound of the knife going through that crust, and it's so crunchy. We'll toast a couple of slices of that and sample it. But first, tell me about this loaf. What's in it?
Sure. So it's got 15% of the flour is a whole dark rye flour. The other 85% of it is King Arthur bread flour. And so bread flour would be a little bit higher protein content. So somewhere in the 12 to 14% protein content range, which is what you want for a hearth loaf like this. So this would be a loaf that's not baked in a pan. It would have been baked on the hearth. So you've got, you know, a stone floor and that wood-fired oven, and you would place this dough directly on that.
Right.
And so you need a flour that's got a little bit more structure to hold that, creates this really nice gluten network. It captures all of those nice air bubbles in there, so you get the nice bubbling inside the crumb, which is the interior of the bread. And then I mixed up the dough on, I fed the sourdough starter Thursday night, and then Friday morning, mixed up the dough, did all the fermentation and the stretching and folding, which is a lot like kneading the bread, but it's much gentler on the bread. And then put it, shaped it, and put it into baskets and put it into the refrigerator on noon Friday. And then I baked it this morning. And so when you keep it at that cold temperature for a long period of time, it really helps to develop a lot of really, really good flavors. And that's something that would have been different today versus, say, the gold miners we were talking about, right? They didn't have refrigeration as an option. So, you know, their breads would have been a little bit different looking from this one. You know, you wouldn't have had the same flavor profile necessarily. You definitely wouldn't have had as much, we call oven spring, which is when you put that loaf in the oven and it puffs up as you bake it. You know, they wouldn't have had that as much. There would have been probably a denser bread than this one.
And so that oven spring is what creates those big air bubbles and...
Yeah, so the air bubbles are there during the fermentation process, but when you heat them up, they get even bigger, right? And as you're heating it, you know, you're starting to get the microbes more active because they're getting warmer up into that threshold to where you kill them. One of my favorite sayings about bread is as a baker, that's the closest you'll ever come to being God, because you raise up this society and this culture and then you destroy it to create the bread.
Well, let's stick a couple of slices in the oven and we will sample it.
Let's do that.
We have several slices about an inch thick of this bread, which has been toasted till it's lightly browned in places, and a little bit of old-fashioned cow butter spread upon it, and I'm going to sample it now. Oh my, that is so good. Just overwhelmingly, the texture just demands your attention. And then the subtle layers of sourness and rich flavor, it's got such depth of flavor. And the crust makes the bread that chewy, strong, crunchy crust. This is wonderful bread, Steve.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you enjoy it.
I'm going to continue to eat noisily in the background while you tell us some more things about sourdough bread. One thing I wanted to query you about was some of the research which is being done today about sourdough bread.
Sure, we can talk about that. Maybe quickly before that, I'll share with you, this is my favorite quote about bread, and it comes from the great gourmand James Beard, and he said about bread, "Good bread is the most fundamentally satisfying of all foods, and good bread with fresh butter the greatest of feasts." And I could not agree more with him.
Amen and amen.
Right. Maybe I would add a little bit of cheese to make it the finest of feasts, but... many a meal I've had is just bread and butter.
Well, it's truly it's obvious why it's a staple of life. What things are they exploring these days about sourdough?
A lot of things, actually. You know, for a long time, probably dating back to the 70s, people have been interested in, you know, what microbes are in sourdough. There was some research at that time where they were really trying to figure out why does San Francisco sourdough so different from everywhere else. And they had identified a strain of lactobacillus bacteria in the sourdough starters in San Francisco. And they aptly named it Lactobacillus San Franciscensis and thought, oh, that must be it. Well, they started looking a little bit more broadly outside of San Francisco and quickly realized that, nope, that's not it, because it's found in everybody's sourdough starters. So a lot of research has been done around that. There's been one that I participated in, and it started back in 2017. And it was a collaboration, and I hope I get all the institutions in there, but a collaboration between North Carolina State University, Tufts University, University of Colorado at Boulder, and the Museum of Natural History in Copenhagen, Denmark, And what it was like a citizen science type of a study where they sent out notifications and sought for all these sourdough bakers to send in a sample of your sourdough starter. And what we're going to do is we're going to take those sourdough starters and we're going to use genetic sequencing to identify all of the yeasts that are in here, all of the bacteria that are in here, and really try to learn what really is the makeup of a sourdough starter. And it's been known that there's yeast and bacteria in there, but really, you know, if you think about it from maybe a more literary sense, you know, it's alchemy, right? It's this magic of I mix flour and water together and pour this sludge in there and magically it makes bread. You know, it's just, what's the science behind that? How can we understand better what's actually in there? And so they collected, I believe they collected about 1,000 samples were submitted, and they took about 500 of those samples and ran the genetic sequencing on it. And I was lucky enough that my sample was one that got chosen to be sequenced. There was also somebody else in Flagstaff, and I don't know who it is, and I've been trying to figure out for the last number of years who it is, that sent in a sample too, and it got sequenced too. So if they're listening, I'd love to talk about
sourdough. We're calling you out. Identify yourself.
Exactly.
Were back histories provided for the samples?
They were. And so they asked questions like, how long have you had the sourdough starter? Where did it come from? Did you make it or was it given to you from somebody else? And so they ended up with a range of from, you know, almost brand new to almost 200 years old. The majority of them were kind of in that 0 to 10 years old range, which at the time that my sourdough starter would have probably fallen in that 10-year old range. They also asked, how do you feed it? How do you store it? All those sorts of things. My starter, you know, like you and I have talked many times, I'm a lazy baker. I don't want to leave it out on the countertop because I'd have to feed it every day. So I feed it once a week and it goes back into the refrigerator. And by far, most of the people who participated in this study, it was very similar. A lot of them, they stored their starters in the refrigerator. And so they went and they did that and they sequenced that. And so what the interesting thing was they found, you know, I think prior to this research, it was assumed like there's a handful of yeasts and a handful of bacteria. But really, it's going to be on the yeast side, it's going to be Saccharomyces cerevisiae, which is, you know, the most predominant yeast. It's the yeast you buy at the store. It's yeast that's used in brewing and in winemaking. And you know, they figured, well, on the bacteria side, maybe it's a handful of different lactobacillus bacteria. And what they found was it's a huge, huge variety of yeast and bacteria that are in there. So my starter on the yeast side, it is predominantly Saccharomyces cerevisiae, but there's 7 other yeast strains that are in there with it in much smaller quantities. And then on the bacterial side, there's about 12 bacteria in my starter. And there again, there was one predominant one that was Lactobacillus paramenteris, and that was like 85%. And there was another one that was about 10%, and the rest of them were very small percentages. And that was, I should say, that was in 2017. Since I submitted that, you know, we had moved across Flagstaff from Doney Park to the other side of town, you know, and so there's definitely changes in the microbes that are, you know, colonizing the houses and things like that. So has it evolved since then? Probably. I'd love them to repeat the study and look at all these starters that were in there and now look at them 5-6 years later and see how they evolved. But that was one big major piece of research, and that got published last year. And you can find the publication online. It was called The Sourdough Project. Really, really interesting, fascinating body of research there. Some other research that was also done by the same groups, and this is one that I find just really, really fascinating. They took, I want to say it was 8 to 10 bakers from all over the world, and they sent them supplies to make a starter. And then they had them convene in Brussels, Belgium, at a place called the Sourdough Library, which we can talk about a little bit later. And so 2 weeks prior to them all convening there, they sent them the exact same flours, water, and everything they need to create a starter and said, go make a starter and then show up in Brussels in 2 weeks with that starter. And we're going to compare and we're going to look at Again, look at what is the genetic profile of those starters. We're going to have you bake breads with those starters, and we'll follow a standardized recipe. And the fascinating thing about it was it all turned out completely different. Every starter was unique. Every bread that they made was unique. And what they did was they also took swabs off of the baker's hands, and they ran that genetic sequence as well. And they learned that, number one, bakers have a lot more lactobacillus and yeasts on their hands than do normal people. And what they had on their hands was very similar to what was in their starters. So a lot of what went into that starter actually came from the baker's own hands. It was, if you will, a part of that baker now into that. And one of the conclusions to that, and I don't think it was actually in the publication, but just one of the authors in an interview said, these bakers, we should actually be able to have them hold their hands out and cup their hands, put water and flour in there, and it'll start to ferment. And I just thought, that was way cool. How fascinating is that?
Tell me more. If someone wanted to start to bake some sourdough bread and they'd never done it before, could you just demystify that a little bit and give a few encouraging words?
Sure. It's not as hard as people think it is. I think some people see sourdough or think sourdough and think it's this really hard, mystical thing, and I just don't know that I can do it. And it's very, very simple. Whenever I teach classes or recommend to people how to get started, there's a whole host of videos on YouTube you can look at. My favorite resources to go to are two. There's a book called Tartine Bread by Chad Robertson, which in my opinion is the best bakery in the United States. He's in San Francisco. If you ever find yourselves in San Francisco and are looking for great bread, number one, Boudin Bakery, number two, Tartine Bakery. But he really goes through, what I like about that book is teaches you how to think like a baker. So the first 100 pages of the book are all about that. And it's all about recognizing, when am I ready to move to the next phase? I've done this, I've mixed this, now what do I do? Well, I watch for this. Making bread is a very sensory process. It's about the feel of the bread, the texture of the dough, the smell of it. I taste the dough. If the dough doesn't taste good, the bread's not going to taste good, certainly. All of those things kind of get you to a point of, okay, I'm ready to move to this next phase of the process. And so he does a great job teaching that. The other great resource is a book called The Sourdough School by Vanessa Kimball. She runs an organization in the UK called The Sourdough School. And it's another great book to learn about basics of sourdough, making sourdough breads. But at the end of the day, it's really not hard. And you're going to make some loaves. They're going to be, you'll look at them and think that they're failures. But when you taste them, they're going to taste better than anything you can buy at the store. So that's a success to begin with right there. And part of your evolution as a baker is you keep doing it. You keep baking them and you keep reading and you keep learning and you do it over and over again. And eventually you get there. And all of a sudden you hey, my first loaf turned out. Look at that. And you get all excited about it and you repeat that same process again. And lo and behold, you start making bread. And I'll just put a warning out there. It's a highly addictive process. And it is a rabbit hole you can go down and spend your entire life doing it.
Well, it was my experience. You showed me some of the basics, gave me a basic recipe and procedure. I've done it many times. Several times approached these wonderful loaves that you're baking. More times than not, they weren't always glamorous, but like you said, they were always delicious and wholesome and well worth the effort. I love that it's literally a hands-on process. And it sort of begs the question, have these bacteria and yeast's been cultivating us for thousands of years to provide them with all the things they need?
That's a great question. And I think they probably have been. When you look at humans, There's been a lot of research recently in the field of the gut microbiome, which are all of those microbes that colonize us in our digestive tracts. And it's like 10 to 1 we are bacteria versus human cells. There are so many bacteria in there. And a lot of the things that you get out of the sourdough are great food for those bacteria in our guts. And so, yeah, I've got no doubt that the bacteria have been farming us versus the other way around.
I know so many diet approaches are steering you away from carbohydrates and breads and so forth. But I have a hard time believing that it's not a healthy addition to the diet.
I agree. I don't think I'd ever do a diet that forced me to cut my sourdough bread out. That would be a non-starter for me.
Well, it's 4 a.m. It's not going to be light for a couple of hours yet, and you're trying to cook over a fire of dried cow chips, and the wind's blowing, and you've got to prepare food for about 6 or 8 men. They're going to be drawing up by the fire here in a few minutes, and you're going to need those sourdough biscuits.
Gladly do it.
It's been such a pleasure having you talk about your experience with sourdough. Is there anything that you wanted to add or that I should have asked you about?
I don't think so. I think you really covered it well. It's always a pleasure to come talk to you about sourdough bread and eat bread together. And it's been a great time and had a lot of fun.
Well, I want to thank you for sharing with our listeners here at Under Western Stars. Under Western Stars comes to you through the support of the historic Museum Club in Flagstaff, Arizona, and the Flagstaff Arts Council has provided a grant which also supports the show. We want to thank them and acknowledge those people behind the scenes that make the show happen. Matt Sarnowski is our faithful engineer, who carries his recording studio in a backpack and bicycles down the road to record our show each time. Jay Jacoby and Greg Hales and Gina Byers all work in the background to help make the show happen and make my website function. If you'd like to go to my website, www.tonynorris.com, you can find all of these shows archived, and you can contact me. So until next time, thanks for tuning in to Under Western Stars.